Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Oh, Brian Koberger. And Mom, that's what we're talking about today. Because it's come out that there seems to be, I don't know, an unhealthy connection going on here, at least from Koberger's standpoint. I'm not trying to criticize Mom at all, but calling your mom for many, many hours within hours after you just murdered 4 people, I think it might say something. I think it might say something about some weird connection there in Koberger's mind, but we're going to break all of this down. Joining me to discuss, Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. We knew that there were those phone calls. We didn't know how long they were. We didn't know how many times it happened throughout the day. It wasn't just right after the murders at 6-something in the morning. It happened in the afternoon, and it happened for long stretches of time. All this now just coming out. When you first started hearing about this, how did your mind start processing it, Robin?
Oh, that's a great question. My first impression was, of course. And then you start on the overlays, because remember, we keep placing ourselves as best we can in his mind about what his needs are. And again, this is purely conjecture, non-scientific, yeah, in the sense of, you know, non-psychologist side of things. I don't want to overstep for people that probably might know this better. But this to me is the not a missing piece necessarily, but definitely a piece that makes sense because of his need for emotional anchoring is what I'm seeing it as. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really comes into my mind is, all right, so you're talking about what for all that time?
Yeah.
And so here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, because people that do horrendous things like he did are people out for retribution. They're full of anger, as he has demonstrated, that we've seen both in the jail and reported by others. And so you wonder what he's doing for all that time. I think he's doing nothing but bitching, moaning, and complaining about how he's a victim to his mother, and his mother is validating the living hell out of him. Talking about reps, I think she has reps of listening to crazy for a lot of years.
And does she see it as crazy? I mean, this is her son. This is little Brian. You know, obviously they know, or they seem to know, that, you know, Brian's a little different. They've spoken to that. The father has talked about that, has talked about help, you know, trying to get him to be friends with a neighbor when he drops him off in Washington, and like, hey, he's a little shy, a little different, you know, take him, be friends. So they know that about their son, at least. But when you're that close all the time, and I'm assuming that, you know, talking for 3 hours a day, maybe not be that huge of a deviation in the life of Brian Koberger, just right, my conjecture. But if you're around it that much, do you think anything stood out in that call? Do you think there was anything odd to her that morning when she gets a call from Brian? And I know there's a big thing about the timestamps on this, 6:17 a.m. And it was like, well, it's a time difference. Yeah, there is a time difference. So it wasn't necessarily, from what I understand, 6:17 a.m. in Pennsylvania. It was 6:17 a.m. in Washington. So that would make it, what time would that make it in on the East Coast? That would make it later.
Probably 2 hours.
Yeah.
Probably so 2 hours.
Three. Yeah. 2 or 3 hours. Anyway, it's early in the morning and it's long calls. What do you think was, what do you think Brian was getting at in these calls other than complaining? Do you think they stood out to Mom, I guess, is the question. Is anything out of the ordinary that day when she
was? So I guarantee you they stood out to Mom. I guarantee they stood out to everyone. I mean, so I communicate with my children, especially my son, a tremendous amount. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether it's your own child or someone that you're in routine contact with. And I mean routine. I mean, a great example is you and I. You and I are in routine contact. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to see if someone's having a slightly different energy day based on our tempo, our energy, our interactions, all these things that we come to baseline as normal from our interactions. It's easy to see if someone's a little off or having a bad day or worse day. And so especially if you're a parent that has routine, very frequent contact with your children or child, especially in this case, you're going to see something that deviates out of norm. I always call it, you know, the force is the force is trembling. I can tell within 2 seconds of picking up the phone with my son whether he's having a good day or bad day or something's off. And that's just in microseconds. And this is from a very, very healthy individual, not someone who just did something as horrendous as Brian. So what I'm guessing is that it spiked out of the norm, probably the timing of the call. Although, you know, hey, things happen during the course of a day. But if he's normally calling at the same time every morning, every other morning, you know, just having an off time for calling is going to be different. I guarantee you his energy on that phone is much different. My conjecture is because they're seeing the event that kind of became the straw that broke the camel's back in his mind, which he's been he was planning this for a long time, but it looked like he, you know, based on, you know, the horrendous reports we're getting of the children that were mutilated by him, it was a rage. And we know he's got rage issues, and it was a lot. I'm guessing that what had happened with the university threw him into a fit of rage. And so if I was thinking I'm Brian Koberger trying to hide it, because I don't think he's going to share with his mom, who's his emotional stability. He doesn't want to rock that only anchor emotionally he has yet anyway. He's going to be probably overly focused on complaining about what's happening at school and justifying all of his chaos in his brain by that. Maybe not even consciously realizing his chaos brain might be even caused from the murders he just committed, because he's not a smart guy to me. I keep saying it. He's not smart at all, because he's completely unaware of himself. He's completely unaware of who he is, because he keeps trying to discover who he is. He copies everyone and everything. Because he's completely empty. So I think it's probably that.
Because right after this initial call, he goes in the bathroom, does his thumbs up picture, goes out, starts driving around, literally calls mom. After the initial phone call, calls her back as he's driving past the house again, which we've seen the video of the car passing by. He's on the phone again with mom. He's obviously not going and saying to mom, hey, there's the house where I just slaughtered those four kids. But like you said, I'm wondering what's coming out of his mouth.
Rage.
But he seemed to be in such a good mood with the thumbs up. Do you think it's rage, or do you think he's in a really good mood talking about positive things that have nothing to do with the murder?
And when I say rage, I mean, so rage to me is also chaos. I think he was spewing incoherently. Okay. I mean, just think about it. Let's put ourselves, you know, from what we understand of what was going on his time period. So he's got a lot of chaos at work. He's got a lot of chaos in his life. He just did something very chaotic, which didn't go according to his plan. And yet he's got a lot of conflicting new emotions he hasn't felt before because he just did something he's never done before. He's also, which was fueled by rage. And so he's up on a lot of adrenaline. Adrenaline's coming down. Then going back to the house, it's going back up. Just look at all the data points we're getting on him during his time frame. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
And if it looks all over the place to us, it's probably all over the place in his brain. And so what he's probably doing, pure conjecture, obviously, spewing all the shit out of his mouth. And what do you typically do? What does his mother probably have reps at in life?
Calming him down.
Calming down her son.
Yeah.
So she might not have even been hearing the content as much as she was just trying to get him to calm down, be safe, stop driving around if she knew he was driving.
Yeah. Or,
you know, get back home. You know, so again, when you're kind of throwing it into the situation itself without judging it, just trying to understand it, that seems to make sense that his brain was, because otherwise, if he was thinking and mirroring what he had studied from these other serial killers or mass murders, because again, he's not technically a serial killer, he's the only thing that deviated from what he studied in others was the fact that he went back to the crime scene so soon after the crime was committed.
Yeah.
That's one of only three things he did that deviated from what others have done. And so that meant he was non-thinking at that point, mm-hmm. in my estimation anyway.
Sure. The fact that he calls them right away, and he's the only person that he has contact with, obviously he doesn't have friends. Right. So his main points of contact, his main people he talks to in his life are mom and dad, it turns out. Probably the only people who are willing to take the time to listen to Brian Koberger.
Of course.
Do you think he was trying, and this is a weird thought, but it entered my mind earlier, in some sort of sick way, like in no way do I think his mom or dad are going to look at this and go, good job, Brian. But do you think there was something in Brian's mind that he's trying to make mom and dad proud? Like he succeeded it without saying what he did. But was there an element of, look, I succeeded at this. Look, I did this. Because I get like that. When you're younger, when you're in your 20s, you start, you know, kind of achieving things, and there's moments in your life that are good, and this is not good, but I think in Koberger's mind, it was good. You like to talk to the people that care about you, that you care about. And a lot of times that's your parents if you have a healthy relationship there. And the fact that he was so all about talking to them that day, is there a level of being proud about this and getting adoration from his parents in some way, shape, or form, but not obviously for the crime, because I'm assuming they don't know about the crime, but in some other way, shape, or form, throwing other things out there where he could get that adoration? Is it just a desperate attempt at something normal after doing something insanely abnormal?
There's an element in there. I'm going to flip it a little bit on the language, I think. So okay. What I'm thinking is that his mother gave him such unconditional, at least from it looks like, mm-hmm. his mother gave him such unconditional acceptance and love and validation that there's no need to impress her because she already thinks he walks on the water.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially, because again, we don't know. From the frequency of contact. So I don't think it was done to try to seek approval or impress his parents in any way, because he did all he did for himself. And to be grandiose in other eyes. You know, I go back to the Ramslin idea on this, is that, you know, he wants to be studied. He wants to be notable. He wants mm-hmm. to be notorious, whether they knew exactly who he was or just as this image of someone to someone like Ramslin, who he respected. So I think from the unrealistic hope that I think people have in situations like this, without saying, hey, look what I did, because that's not right. He can't do that. Is that because of the amount of bitching, moaning, and complaining he was doing, he's seeking to hear his mother help him rationalize that, oh, well, it would make sense, you know, listen to all this, that these people would deserve to die.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's hoping to hear someone, the only person that understands and accepts him non-judgmentally, help him rationalize the horrendous things he just did without him having to ask for it.
Yeah.
So he's hoping, I'm like, why keep calling otherwise? Besides venting, people in our lives. So we want people to rationalize our behavior for us so we can accept it. So they accept us.
I mean, as much as in cold and callous as Koberger is, it feels like mom and dad are the security blanket in some way, shape, or form to him. And just the familiarity of speaking to them in his chaotic mind, maybe that presents some sort of calm or peace.
It is. It's routine. Routine makes us safe. Yep. You know, especially, you know, my wife's a teacher and they just went back to school, and some of the things that, and your daughter too just went back. Yeah. And at every age, but especially at a younger age, or especially if our minds are not developing as fast as the people around us, and I think Koberger is part of this, is that one of the things that helps us feel safe is routine.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that routine is a call home. It's why he kept doing it in jail. It's why people, I've watched a lot of these videos of people that are former prisoners, you know, former inmates, you know, the things that make people and inmates feel safe in jail is the daily routine. You start mm-hmm. screwing with a routine, man, and people go bonkers on you.
Yeah.
Because routine helps us feel safe. And so I think part of his routine was not just the unconditional validation he's getting from his mother, but the routine of talking to his mother. I mean, my kids do it with me too. I mean, the routine of texting, you know, my kids of when and how, and, you know, it allows us both to feel safe and comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
No, and so I think that's part of what he was looking for.
The verbiage that Koberger used when talking about his parents is rather interesting. Mm-hmm. Mother, father, very, very formal. Some may say Norman Batesy. That's what I got out of it right away. But that's how they were labeled in his phone. Mother, father. And then a text to his dad. Why? I'm just paraphrasing. I don't have the exact text in front of me. But it's something to the effect of, father, why is mother not answering the phone? There's a lot to unpack. I mean, me and my daughter joke like that. Like, I'll pick her up from school like, hello, daughter. Hello, father. How was your day? And but it's in jest.
Very Wednesday Addams.
Yes, we're making fun of it's satire of anyone who would talk like that. But this is real. This is how he communicates. This is how he this is how he refers to them. Your thoughts on that, oh behavioral genius?
Empty shell. Yeah. When you're an empty shell without emotion and without empathy, you resolve to label the labels and meanings that are descriptive.
Yeah.
That's it. And it's remember, there's when thinking of Koberger, so many times people are really overthinking this guy. He is so completely empty.
Yeah.
That's why I was talking about this the other day. I think it was probably with you. So all we do is talk about this guy. You know, he is so devoid of absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
That there's nothing there but what society puts into it or what he's choosing for society that he takes from it. And so a label of mother and father, well, that's the label. That's what they are. They're mother and father. So I'm going to call them mother and father unless I'm trying to mimic and mirror something else that's more appropriate in the situation. Because we've seen and heard from other people, at times he can be very charming. Well, that was a script he rehearsed in that time period. Mm-hmm. If you catch him off guard in a situation that he doesn't have a script for, that he hasn't studied someone for, he has no idea what to do. This is why he sucked so bad at destroying four lives, because he couldn't think.
Yeah, went off
script.
He was
mimicking. Yeah. He's mimicking in a stovepipe like this.
What do you make of Christmas? He's back home. Obviously, they don't know that it's him yet. And his phone records show what we do know, because he obviously deleted a lot of stuff. But what he didn't delete was that search history on Christmas Day. And he's looking at more than 20 serial killers. Merry Christmas. That's his activity on Christmas Day, researching serial killers. Now, I can't say that's something I wouldn't do if I'm bored and I'm getting ready for the show, but he just killed four people and it's Christmas Day and he's researching 20 serial killers. What's he searching for?
I don't think the date matters to him.
Yeah.
For one thing, Christmas, you know, it's just another day.
Yeah.
No, so I don't think it's tied to anything. I think it's probably tied into when the house is quiet, no one's around because it's Christmas. Maybe everyone's sleeping late, but him.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a convenient time. I don't think it regards Christmas at all as an event in his life. Researching all these other people, though, that was interesting. I took a deeper dive on a few of them that he was looking at because I just think he's studying more. It's literally came down. All right, I got away with this one. I got to do a deeper dive. I think he's just constantly taking in data for trying to do something better. It's like, you know, like I'm thinking what I learned from Ramsland was good, but I think I can do better. You know, let me expand my network of individuals I'm researching to kind of look at nooks and crannies. What did I miss? What could I do better next time? Because remember, he's only a mass murderer, but most of our conjecture is that it was going to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's researching. Why wouldn't he do it again?
And he hadn't been caught yet. Yeah. I mean, it had been weeks. I wonder if he thought he was getting away with it. I mean, what do you think?
Or he had loose ends of what he needed to take care of, like knives or blood or clothes, or there's things that he was ruminating on in his head doing an after action report that he didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to figure out what to do is he doesn't innovate anything on his own. He looks it up in someone else. And so my theory is there's loose ends that he thinks he could have done better. So what am I doing? I'm going to research other people, not me. I'm going to research other people and see what they did.
The people he was researching, and I don't know if you know the answer to this. I think you looked into it more than I did. The people, the serial killers, the mass murderers that he was looking up, I'm wondering how long they evaded capture. And I'm wondering if at that moment in time, he had a feeling the walls were closing in. Because by this moment, they're looking for the car. They're looking for his, he knows that they're onto his car. And if they're onto his car, that's kind of scary. Shit, I got that car. How do they know that? They know something about me. He knows the knife sheath was left behind. He's concerned about that. I'm wondering, and he's sitting there with gloves on, moving things and packing his trash and putting it in the neighbors. There's a level of paranoia going on here. I'm wondering if he was researching these other 20 killers to see the tactics that they used to evade police capture when they thought maybe things were closing in. I'm wondering if he was trying to learn another lesson from those. I'd have to look at the list of who he was looking up because I didn't do that. I just read the headline and a bit of the story.
Yeah, so the big one he was mirroring, looking at a lot of, was Danny Rawling. Okay. And he had a striking over. So this is the guy that actually attacked using a K-bar as well.
No shit.
Okay. And parallels a lot of the things that he was doing, like attacking through the screen door, sliding doors, secreting the weapon in a, he said, at least in a barn afterwards, or abandoned something or other, like the theory that I have that he didn't dump it in the river, that is actually in a hidey hole someplace. This guy did exactly the same thing. At least he said he did in prison after the fact. And so the MO of this guy, Rawlings, seems to fit. And I don't think he studied Rawling under Ramsland either. So that's why he's a conglomeration, like we all are. You know, we learn a lot of lessons from a lot of people and then we make it our own and innovate ourselves. But that's not what Goldberger did. He definitely, or BK, so we don't give him a name.
Yeah.
He definitely did not innovate anything. He's just constantly copying someone on something. So that's what he's taken from Rawling, it looked like.
He was arrested 11 days after his murder. Rawling was. This happened in 1990.
But I thought he had a series of them that he got away with for a number of years first.
From his last murder, you're right.
Right.
To the arrest, you're right. So he did get away for quite some time. There's a whole, I just did a little type in ChatGPT, and there's a whole other show we can do about the similarities here between those two.
Yeah.
That's for next time.
The interesting thing, and Tony, you brought up a really interesting thing too. And I thought at the very, very beginning of this about him being caught actually bagging up his trash at home and mm-hmm. taking a lot of care of it. That was interesting because did he think that they're on to him already? Even though his first words that they've reported out of his mouth were, what was it?
Did you arrest anybody else? Something to that
right.
nature.
Yeah. Yeah. Some to the effect that, you know, not just me, someone else. Mm-hmm. But the fact that, because again, I'm having a hard time overlaying the fact that he seemed very, very stovepiped mm-hmm. with his pre-event, the event itself, and after the event, planning and execution, that I would have thought that his post-event behavior would have been limited to the Moscow area and his house where he lived in Pullman mm-hmm. and not extended to Pennsylvania, because he kind of operated like this.
Yeah.
The fact that he was extending that behavior, because again, he didn't turn the cell phone off 3 days prior. He didn't turn the cell phone off right after. He turned his cell phone off during the event itself. It shows a very stovepipe mentality about me executing right here.
Yeah.
And the fact that he extended his behavior of evasion back in Pennsylvania, or initiated it back in Pennsylvania because he was stopped twice on the way home, maybe mm-hmm. that was alerting to him to expand his stovepipe of post-event activities, which might have then triggered, uh-oh, I might be being looked at. Let me do some research, like to what you're saying. Let me do some research on what these people did. Mm-hmm. Let me expand and see what other data I can bring in to adjust my behavior from this point forward. Because obviously who I studied so far wasn't enough, because I'm being looked at. I'm being tracked.
And that's
I just convinced myself of my own words.
You did. Good. Look at that. But because if you look at some, look, I don't believe, I think they're wrong on the Papa Roger. I think it was Koberger.
I
just disagree. I think it's the odds of it not being him are insane and nearly impossible.
It goes back to, then why wouldn't this person come forward right now?
Exactly.
If you were Papa Roger and you're out there, why not come forward and say, look, I was the guy. Because talk about being interviewed, talk about being notorious or infamous at the very least, you know, just come forward now then.
So I'm going to assume it was him. And he was out there and he was trying to communicate and he was trying to put red herrings out there. When people were starting to look at the Elantra, the first thing he did was, whoa, maybe it's not this. Or I forgot what he said exactly. But he knew about the sheath. He had to get that out there, which was creepy and weird because nobody else publicly knew about that. And yeah, I think he thought he was going to steer the ship initially and steer
people. He kept going to these emotions, you know, which is what someone who doesn't feel emotions would want to know. Because remember, that was the same survey he put out to all these other criminals and all these people behind bars. What was the emotion? What were you thinking? What were you feeling? Yeah. You know, and that's what he was posting on as Papa Roger too. It wasn't necessarily, I mean, granted, he had details that no one had at that point, apparently. But at the same time, though, he is so focused on the emotions that must have been felt by everyone else around him. I mean, so was the creepy part to everyone.
No, it very much was. What's your take on the prison stuff that's going on with Brian Koberger now?
I'm sorry, that's my happy. I shouldn't be doing a happy dance, but man.
Oh, I'm doing happy dances. I think it's great.
So here's what's awesome. He is, for all the people that believe in it, that think he should, you know, believe in hell, that he should just be executed and burning in hell. I think the living hell he's in right now is much better.
Yeah.
I mean, so think about this. So you asked me when we started the show today, you know, what was my first thought when learning about these phone calls with his mother?
Yeah.
Was that, oh, he's being tortured even more now because he can't talk to mommy.
Yeah.
And so not only is he being tortured by his fellow inmates and God bless those horrible people that are torturing him, right?
God bless those horrible people who are torturing him.
But he can't even talk to his mother. Yeah. I mean, can you imagine? It's the only emotional anchor that was probably anchoring that broken, friggin' horrendous brain of his was his mother. Mm-hmm. It's gone out the window. And these people surrounding him in prison are cascading it on top of him.
Yeah.
And he's making it worse by complaining. Oh, it's great. It's just, this is the best thing ever.
I know.
You know, the conclaves have got to be like just pumping fists right now saying, pour it on, man.
Yeah. I mean, the staff, from what we understood, from what's been reported, they were kind of taken aback by this, that suddenly, like, this was coordinated efforts to torture him specifically. People come and go from these areas all the time, and they don't get this sort of attention like this. But when Koberger came in, they knew who they were getting. I'm guessing many of them listened to these shows and had an idea that he's coming in. I'm guessing canteens are being filled, right?
Can you imagine? I love, you know, kind of thinking about all these different individuals that are involved in this, not just from our optic, but so now let's place ourselves in that prison that you are one of those people that are in isolation. A lot of those people, from what I understand, are on death row. Mm-hmm. When was the last time you think anyone in the entire world, one, knew their name, which we don't know, but cheered for them, celebrated their actions because of what they did?
Yeah.
And now they are, because of what they're doing to this person that's even worse than them. So in other words, they're having potentially in their own mind the ability to make amends and right their own wrongs by tormenting this guy because he's worse than us, according to everyone else in the world.
It's kind of one of those things where it's like, well, at least you did something good in your life.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's not redemption for whatever horrible crimes that got them there, but at least something good is happening out of this. I wouldn't cheer for torturing anyone for the most part, but Koberger, I'm good with it. I don't know that there's any other way to get through to this man, and I don't know that you're ever going to get through to him. Is this something, is he ever going to get out of solitary confinement? Is this, I mean, I don't think he won't survive. I mean,
I hope so.
I do too. But I'm like, is this one of those where it's like, you just really can't, because you look at the track record of all these other high profile ones, they're dead in days in a lot of cases.
Yeah, they can. And at a certain point too, they got to make sure that they might have to put a suicide vest on him. Yeah. He's going to, if his brain hasn't broken already from this, it's not only isolation, but it's not physical isolation, because he's in physical isolation, but not because he's surrounded so closely. Because they said he's not in isolation as punishment, which is more severe than what he's in. He's in isolation for safety, and so he is surrounded by other people, just separated by a wall and just they can hear through vents, obviously. But the other thing that I thought of when learning about this connection to his mother, I said, oh, that's good. Because that means he does require a human connection to at least one person that has completely been severed.
Yeah.
Which is even more torturous for him.
And he's so obsessed, like you were saying earlier, with how does this make one feel, with the thinking. That's in, well, he couldn't really manage normal thinking in the free world. Now he's taking on something most of us never are going to be able to comprehend, being in that sort of isolation. In a cell, you know, 23 hours a day, every day of your life. Now, that's going to be a lesson right there in mental competency and staying sane. So he gets another little lesson there, I guess, in something.
I don't think he's going to. I have a hard time imagining him being able to adjust. And it's not because – so our brains, the neuroplasticity of our brains, we can adjust to a lot of things to start establishing new routines. Because, again, it's routine that allows us to feel safe and start – moving forward. But if the other inmates are not allowing him to fall into routine because of them keeping him awake, or even just inconsistent with a sleep pattern, doesn't even have to be 24/7. It just has to be so disruptive to a normal routine that it keeps him on edge all the time. Psychologically, everyone will break, especially him, because he's just got a big broken brain. Again, I don't know the impact on a pre-broken brain to break it even more, but something, it's a hard time not imagining him just turn into a vegetable.
What if the opposite happens here? What if he comes out of this like a normal person? Like somehow solitary turn him normal. It's like he comes out, like being hey, everybody, like how's it going?
It's like being kicked by a mule in the head one day and then the next day it makes you better.
No. Exactly. I don't think that's going to happen, but wouldn't that be insane? So.
I don't think it's going to happen. I think so. playing this tape forward, if at some point one day down the road someone has the ability to interview him for a study, for whatever they're going to do, for a book or something, I think they're going to bring him up. Did you ever watch The Green Mile?
Yeah.
Probably.
Long time ago. And
remember when the first time they brought Billy in?
It's been 20 years.
So they brought this one inmate in who was pretending to be all drugged up on dope, you know, to keep him sedated. And they're bringing him on the Green Mile for the first time. Actually, he actually played one of the roles opposite of Billy in White Lotus. We were talking about Goggins beforehand. Yep. So he played opposite of Goggins in the latest series of White Lotus. Anyway, so this character comes in, is completely drooling. He looks all doped up and he's just shuffling his feet. That's what I imagine Coburg is going to look like the first time he's being interviewed by someone trying to do a study on him, because his brain is going to be so broken. There's just nothing but drool coming out of him.
Can't learn much then.
Nope. I'm going so dark and horrible on this one. I apologize, but I'm just like, I don't celebrate anyone ever. I've never done this. I've never celebrated or thought positively about someone being in such discomfort except this guy.
No, I really am not while they were alive. After Dahmer, I was like, well, you have that coming. This one's still in process.
Think about people like that. You know, it's like we've looked at Dennis Rader, Dahmer, you know, all these other people. And all of them had interesting points about them. It was like, wow, but they're actually kind of charismatic here. That's interesting. How did they do that? You know, so other people became much more interesting because there's a lot of depth to them in different areas, not positive depth, but just elements of them that made them a little more interesting to look at. Mm-hmm. This is the most abhorrent individual I've ever seen in my life. He really is.
He's just a copy and paste of other people's shit.
Yeah, and is the worst of the shit.
Yeah, and that's all it is. Beyond the copy and paste, he's a shell. And that's why there's not – I don't think there's a lot to study here other than he just copy and pasted a bunch of stuff and this is what you got.
Well, that's what makes him a thing to study, is because he is so empty of everything. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I know people that do this a lot longer, a lot more than I ever have, that I've probably seen something similar. But in the cases that you and I have covered, not even close.
No, this is such a unique one. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and author of, I'm going to hold up this one, A Unbreakable Alliances. It's the latest one, but there's other great ones too. My girlfriend's actually reading this one. Or no,
that's a favorite.
Who's reading this one? Stacy, I think, is reading this one right now. Stacy's reading this. I'm trying to think who told me they're reading this right now. Stacy's reading this one right now. So, sizing people up, another one, wherever books are sold.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.